chances are you're working from home a lot more these days. Hi, I'm Sam Evans Brown, host of Outside In, and if you're like me, you're driving much less. And perhaps you're wondering what to do with that old vehicle you no longer need. Well, you can donate it to NHPR and turn those many miles into shows that you love, like Morning Edition, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and Outside In. We'll take care of the paperwork and arrange to have it picked up for free at nhpr.org/car donation.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. The scientists said it was likely to happen, and now it's happening. New Hampshire and the country as a whole are looking at a fall wave of COVID-19 cases. Election Day is just days away, so what do we need to know if we've not yet cast a ballot? And speaking of ballots, people are voting for more than just president, so who are you choosing for county commissioner? We're going to look down ballot later today on the roundup, but let's start with a conversation with David Brooks, reporter for the Concord Monitor and blogger at Granite Geek, the column covering science and technology. He's been looking at a rise in cases of COVID-19. David, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
And listeners, now's the time to ask your questions about the rise in COVID-19 cases. If you have questions, give us a call. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also email exchange@nhpr.org. So, David, you've been looking at a lot of metrics. What metrics on COVID-19 did you choose to analyze, and why those?
Why those? Yeah, so this started early in the summer when we were sort of getting besieged with numbers, and it was all new to us, and we didn't really know what to look at. And so I poked around, and a bunch of places were doing this, and I chose four, actually expanded to five now, metrics that I look at every week, kind of get a sense as to kind of, you know, how it's doing in the state. I look at whether the number of new hospitalizations is going up, which it isn't. I look at whether there's been a two-week drop in new cases, which is unfortunately not happening. I look at the absolute number of new cases reported every day. Chose a figure of four new cases per 100,000 people, which seemed to be a fairly common point at which the virus might be becoming prevalent. That's 54 new cases a day in New Hampshire, and unfortunately we're well above that. I also look at two things about testing, because obviously testing is key. Whether we're doing at least 150 PCR tests per 100,000 people per day, which we've been doing for a while now, and whether the positive rate of the PCR test is below 5%, which is often used as a metric of widespread. Those two last two might be changing because, of course, the state has now added antigen tests to their data. We're starting to do a fair amount of those.
Okay. And what are the metrics that you feel are most meaningful? In other words, does it say the whole picture if we're getting more tests done? Is the positivity rate the one we should really be looking at, or are all of these combined sort of telling the whole picture?
Yeah, obviously I'm not an epidemiologist. To me, it's all of them combined. You can fixate on some of them. It's easy to do day to day. I have a two-week average for most of mine, which is a little bit longer than most, because I just, it's, you know, things go up and down and up and down, and you can get whipsawed. The positive rate for testing is a very important one. Surprisingly, I think the antigen positive rate has been much higher than PCR. I'm not quite sure what that means. But, you know, if a positive rate is high, but you're not getting very many new tests, then it's not as important. And if you get lots and lots and lots of new cases, but the positive rate is low, does that just a sign you're doing testing really well? I think it requires all of them, and you've got to realize that there's an element of, subjectivity in this. There's no absolute where you can crank it through a machine. Mm-hmm. It will say, you know, you're good, you're bad.
And David, you mentioned two kinds of tests, antigen and PCR. What are the differences between those two tests?
PCR looks for the actual DNA, and antigen looks for the proteins that are on the outside of the virus. I'm sorry, PCR looks for the actual genetic material of the virus itself, and antigen looks for the proteins on the outside. PCR is more accurate, but it takes longer. It's a more complicated test. The antigen is just It's literally, you can, you know, stick one of those little tabs into a chemical reaction, and if it turns blue, you've got it. It has more false positives or false negatives. I forget which one it is more like an antigen. So it's a little less accurate, so you need to be careful with it, but it's fast. You can get it in 15 minutes usually.
And is one more accessible to the general public than the other? In other words, if we roll up to your Walgreens or something, which one are we getting?
That, you know, to be honest, I'm not quite sure what all Walgreens is doing. I mean, if they're giving you the answer quickly, they're doing antigen.
Okay.
Because PCR needs to be sent away to a lab. I don't think they give you instant answers. So I'm assuming it's a PCR test. They've contracted with a lab somewhere to do those.
Okay. So. David, you've written a little compare contrast between COVID-19 and the devastating flu of 100 years ago. Well, let's run through the similarities first and then get to the differences. How are they similar?
Now, the similarities are kind of scary, actually, because the quote Spanish flu, as it's known, even though it didn't start in Spain, in the U.S., it first showed up in March of 1918, was kind of bad and went away in the summer and came screaming back in the fall and winter. And that's when most of the deaths happened. I mean, there were, you know, hundreds of thousands, maybe as many as 600,000 deaths in the U.S. when it was all done. And it didn't end until the spring of 1919, so it lasted quite a long time. So you could look at the numbers that are happening right now, and the new caseload is going way up. It's going up as fast as it did at the start. I'm in New Hampshire, I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm. And because so many of us are...
Oh,
David, could I interrupt for a second? Because so many of us are looking forward to the end of COVID-19. How did the 100 years ago end?
It sort of faded out. Frankly,
did we reach herd immunity? You know,
I hate that phrase because it sounds magic and it sounds like, okay, we're great. Everybody's surrounded by a little shell and the virus can't get to us. It doesn't work that way. What happened is, you know, so many people died. So many people got sick. Of course, World War One had killed people too, that there weren't enough people for it to circulate widely. There weren't enough unaffected people for it to circulate widely anymore.
And that's one of the differences too, right? Because people travel more now or can travel farther, faster now than they could 100 years
ago.
Go ahead.
No, that's fine. I'm sorry. Yeah, you're absolutely correct. And that's the biggest difference now and then. I mean, back in 1919, not very many people really went far from their home. In fact, it was World War One that made it spread because it was the soldiers going overseas that sent it back and forth. And now we've got the equivalent of, you know, people going overseas all the time. So trying to contain the virus now is much more difficult than it was a century ago. On the other hand, we have vaccination coming, hopefully, in a year or so, whereas we did not have that a century ago. So that's the bright point.
And speaking of vaccinations, you know, we don't have one for COVID-19 yet, but the state seems to be making a push for folks to get vaccinated for the seasonal flu. Maybe that's just my perception and not reality. Is the state actually making a greater push this year to encourage people to get vaccinated for the seasonal flu?
They are. Everybody is. All health folks are. I've gotten my shot already, by the way. I hope you have.
I did too. I got it Wednesday.
Yeah, there you go. Good man. So the reason is, well, the flu is always a problem. I mean, hundreds of people died from the flu in New Hampshire. But the problem is that the symptoms for the flu are very similar to the symptoms for COVID. So if a lot of people start coming down with the flu, that is going to greatly complicate our attempts to keep an eye on COVID and keep it under control. And if people start getting sick with the flu and have to go into the hospital, there's many fewer beds for people who get sick from COVID. So that's really the reason, is it's, you don't want what they call a twindemic. You don't want your flu pandemic at the same time as we're wrestling with the COVID pandemic. So yeah, people, I realize the flu shot is imperfect, and yeah, I know all the arguments, yada, 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 but just, you know, go get your flu shot this year.
We get this question, why does New Hampshire have more than three times the COVID deaths as Maine? According to Johns Hopkins today, New Hampshire had 9,994 cases and 470 deaths. Maine has 6,064 cases, 146 deaths. New Hampshire and Maine both have 1.3 million residents. So why the difference? This person writes, I think it may be due to stricter prevention measures in Maine. Maine has a mask mandate. New Hampshire doesn't. And that's just one example. So I don't know, David, what do you think?
Well, that's a good question. And So virtually all the deaths, as you well know, the NHPR has reported this really well, have been in long-term healthcare facilities. So this is, it's not like there's widespread death in the community at a whole. Almost all the deaths have been people over 60 and generally over 70, mm-hmm. which is, of course, a tragedy, but it's a very focused part. And frankly, I don't know what the long-term care facilities are like in Maine. I don't know if they have as many, and perhaps there's more of them on a per capita basis in New Hampshire than there are in Maine. But it's very much a localized part of the state as a whole. So mask mandates, they're effective. They have their problems. They have their pushback. But there's no question, if you could magically make everybody wear a mask and behave really, really well in terms of not interacting with each other, the virus would go way down. But society would grind to a halt. So it's a tricky balancing act.
Well, David Brooks of the Concord Monitor, thank you very much for spending some time with us today. Really appreciate it.
You bet.
And you can find all of David's reporting at the ConcordMonitor.com. We'll put a link to his reporting at our website, NHPR.org. And listeners, just a reminder that Dr. Benjamin Chan, a state epidemiologist for New Hampshire, and Dr. Elizabeth Talbot, infectious disease specialist at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center, will be on the exchange on Wednesday, October 28th, to take your questions about the rise of COVID-19 cases here. Again, that's on Wednesday, October 28th. Right here on the exchange on NHPR. Right now, we're going to spend some time speaking with Nancy West, executive editor of InDepthNH.org, a news website published by the New Hampshire Center for Public Interest Journalism. It's been reporting extensively on efforts to keep residents of the state's nursing homes safe during the pandemic. As we just heard from David Brooks, they've been hit pretty hard by the COVID-19 pandemic. Nancy West, thank you for being on the program.
Oh, thank you for having me, Peter.
So what led you to do this series about nursing home safety?
Actually, we got interested in this series after reading ProPublica's piece. ProPublica did a really wide look at all of the nursing homes in the country. And they used a lot of Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services data, which is all public information. And that made us really want to take a deeper look into New Hampshire's nursing homes.
And what did you find overall about the nursing homes and how they are handling the pandemic? What are you finding?
Well, overall, Bob Charest, our reporter, examined lots of public records. He looked at nursing home inspection reports, COVID-19 cases, infection control procedures, the ownership of the different nursing homes, staffing ratios at the nursing homes, and really found no correlation between whether or not these were deemed one-star or five-star rated nursing homes by the CMS and the number of outbreaks or the number of deaths in nursing homes. What he did find was the only sure statement you could make about outbreaks in nursing homes was that they really broke out around clusters of places where there was a lot of community transmission and a lot of community cases of COVID-19. Charest found that, for instance, a lot of the nursing homes were right around the Manchester-Boston area, with a scattering around the state from the seacoast to Salem and Nashua, where there were a lot of cluster, nursing home outbreaks. And oddly, there were none. Not oddly, because it's not near population centers, there were none in the Upper Valley and none north of Campden. So in taking this deep dive, it really revealed a lot about what's going on in the state's nursing homes.
And you've been covering the work of the Committee to Study the Safety of Residents and Employees at Long-Term Care Facilities, which has been examining cost controls in long-term care, the personal protective equipment situation, and policies on infection control, among other things. That committee completed its work recently, releasing 15 recommendations. Don't need you to run through all 15, but what are some of the main issues they're addressing?
I think some of the main things is staffing shortage and low pay. And we've known this since way before the pandemic. This is a job that is very difficult to do, working in nursing homes, working with the elderly. And they're just very low pay jobs. And there's a lot of burnout right now. I think Bob starts out his, you know, the whole series talking about the low pay, the burnout. And one of the major recommendations is for Governor Sununu to return this $300 a week stipend to nursing home workers.
That had been going on for a while, right?
Yeah, that ran from April till it ended in the end of July. That was one of their major recommendations, although all 15 are worth reading. Bob Charest did a report on it today. We'll continue to follow even after this five-part series, but that was one of the major ones.
Brendan Williams, president and CEO of the New Hampshire Healthcare Association, has been critical of the amount of money set aside for nursing homes and accused Governor Sununu of not releasing additional funds. How has the governor responded to that?
Well, the governor says that not only did this $300 stipend end in, I believe it ended in June, and then he re-upped it for another month and doesn't feel it's necessary right now. I think there's a disagreement there for sure. But all of the experts that testified before this legislative committee, not one of them said there was enough money in nursing home wages to make it work. The other problem is New Hampshire is one of the lowest reimbursed, gets the lowest, one of the lowest reimbursements from Medicaid for each nursing home patients, for the low income nursing home patients. And that has been really, you know, detrimental to a lot of the nursing homes, especially the bottom line finances. You know, a lot of them were on the verge of financial collapse even before, not a lot, but some were on the verge of financial collapse even before the pandemic. And this has really harmed them. And Brendan Williams points out that of the billions of dollars that the federal government set aside for healthcare facilities, something like only 4% went to, was earmarked for nursing homes or long-term care facilities. And that's where 40% of the deaths nationally have occurred. It's been, most of the money has gone to hospitals, which also need the funding, but nursing homes, Williams and many other experts who testified feel have really been shortchanged in the money end here. And they have the greatest need, among the greatest needs.
Let's just mention one other thing regarding price gouging, because the exchange has been in touch with the senior support team, a statewide group of volunteers in touch with dozens of facilities on a daily basis. And they've reported price gouging problems for PPE in particular. A box of gloves, normally a $10 or $12 purchase, now costing $90, $100. What are you seeing on this front? Is there any evidence that this is happening in a widespread manner?
Yes, we've heard this is a problem all along. And it's really incredible that how much people are charging for, you know, personal protective equipment that people need to do their jobs every day in nursing homes. That's one of the recommendations from this study committee, is to get on top of this price gouging and to end it.
What about surveillance testing? Is that still happening, or is it happening? Has it ever started happening at all of these nursing homes?
Yes, it's started at first in the Rockingham County and Hillsborough County, and it's gone to the other counties. The shift this week, or very soon if it hasn't already started, is the state is putting the onus on to the nursing homes to do the testing themselves. And there's been some concern among the nursing homes that they will not be able to get the good price, especially the smaller nursing homes. They will have to pay more than the larger nursing homes for the testing, for instance. The state's going to reimburse them $100 per test, but expert testimony before this particular committee, and just anecdotally, you know, in talking with different nursing home administrators, that may not be enough. And it is an extra burden on the nursing home administrators.
So, Nancy, as InDepthNH.org continues to watch what's happening at nursing homes, what in particular will reporters there be looking for?
Well, we'll be looking to see if the governor accepts and puts into action the recommendations by the study commission. As of yesterday, they just finished wrapping up their draft report, and it was on the way to Governor Sununu's office. And it will be interesting to see what the state is willing to do as far as having a real dialogue about the needs for the elderly. There's another group called the Citizens for Home Care. That may not be the correct name, but there's also a movement to try to keep more elderly people in their own homes, if that's what they choose, and to earmark some funding for that kind of venture. They say there's really just not enough for the many people that would like to stay in their own homes. And we need to have a real debate, and not just a debate, a real dialogue, a real conversation about how we're going to protect the elderly. You know, as Gary Reno did one of the five-part series is the politics of the pandemic. And he started his story saying, you know, every year it's sort of the joke at the legislature, are we going to protect the elderly or the kids this year? Because there's not enough money for both. I think we have to start looking at making sure there's enough money for both, and especially for elderly. One thing this pandemic has shown is the underbelly of what's going on in nursing homes. We published many of the inspection reports to show what the government is looking at when it goes into a nursing home to conduct these investigations. And this is our legacy to our kids, is to make sure that when they are aged, they have a system in place, nursing homes in place, that people would be proud to send their loved ones too. We're lucky in the CMS rating, the 1 to 5 star, more than half of the nursing homes in New Hampshire rank either above average or average for the care of their elderly.
And Nancy, and at in-depthnh.org, I looked at this list, and it's really comprehensive. And listeners, you check it out if you're interested in what's going on in nursing homes and how they're rated. We have to let you go, Nancy, but I do appreciate you being on the show. Executive editor of in-depthnh.org, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you, Peter. Have a great day.
Remember, listeners, we're linking to all the stories we're talking about today on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. And coming up after a short break, we're going to speak with NHPR's Casey McDermott, who has been here reliably on the Roundup to answer your questions about voting during this pandemic. So what questions do you have? Now's the best time to call. The number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You could also email us. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for joining me. Election Day is just 2 weeks away, less than 2 weeks away, but people are voting now. It's less an election day than an election season. And because COVID-19 has made voting absentee a reality for so many people who would otherwise vote in person, it's gotten a little complicated. It's a new thing for a lot of people. So to untangle this knot, we turn to NHPR's Casey McDermott. Casey, thank you very much for being here this morning.
Thanks for having me.
And listeners, now's a great time to call if you have questions about your absentee ballot. How are you getting it done? What are you concerned about? Our number is 1-800-892-6477. You can also email exchange@nhpr.org. Casey, in the news this week, college students and their ability to vote in New Hampshire was called into question, forcing the state attorney general's office to respond. So run through for us, if you could, what the objection was this time.
Sure. So the New Hampshire Republican Party put a letter out to the AG's office about a week ago now, basically calling on the state to clarify, in their view, the eligibility of student voters. And they were asking the state specifically to say that student voters who are out of the state right now, who do not have a current New Hampshire address, who are learning remotely due to the pandemic or what have you, they asked the state to clarify that those people should not be allowed to cast a ballot in New Hampshire. And what has since happened is that the New Hampshire Attorney General's office on Wednesday this week affirmed that college students who previously registered to vote in New Hampshire do not automatically lose their voting eligibility if they're out of state due to, for example, remote learning or other circumstances. And what's important to note here is that, you know, the AG's office said they can't offer broad guidance on, you know, every possible scenario because voting eligibility, in their words, quote, hinges on the facts relevant to that particular individual. So it's you know, a collection of kind of criteria. But what the AG's office did say is that, you know, someone doesn't give up their ability to vote in New Hampshire due to a temporary absence. And someone also can't vote in New Hampshire if they've never established a physical presence here to begin with. So that was the AG's office response to the attorney, or excuse me, to the Republican Party's letter on this. We should note that the Republican Party was not entirely satisfied with that response from the AG's office. It's unclear what, you know, follow-up measures the party may or may not be taking to, you know, follow up on this at this point. But they have asked the state to further clarify eligibility for a variety of specific scenarios that they have outlined that could apply hypothetically to student voters.
Okay, so is there a next step you'll be watching for as that story unfolds?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're just looking to see whether there's any kind of formal action by the Republican Party on this. In the meantime, you know, I should say I've been talking to some student voters. I've been keeping an eye on, you know, voter registration, voter turnout activities on, you know, relative to students across the state. And, you know, there are steps that are being taken at, you know, Dartmouth, for example, or UNH or other colleges to help students register to vote if they're, you know, in the state right now. There's also measures that have been taken. I know there's an effort at Dartmouth to help students who are temporarily absent apply for absentee ballots. So that's something that we've also been looking into and will continue to keep an eye on.
Another story that you reported on this week, Casey, was that the Democratic Party is expanding its voter hotline with 8 languages. I'm curious, have the Democrats always gone this far to reach out to people who don't speak English?
No, this is a first time, you know, to my knowledge, this is a first time effort. And that's part of the reason, excuse me, why we reported on it is because, you know, we have done a lot of coverage lately at NHPR about some of the language barriers inherent in New Hampshire's voting system. In order to vote, you do have to be a U.S. citizen, and that requires a level of English proficiency as part of that process. However, I think, you know, I don't think it's a surprise to anyone who's looked at New Hampshire's voting paperwork that it can be kind of complicated, even for people who are fluent in English. So one of the things that the New Hampshire Democratic Party has done is that they are now rolling out additional language assistance for their voter hotline, and they're providing that in Spanish, French, Mandarin, Cantonese, Indonesian, Vietnamese, Korean, and Nepali. And they've focused on those because those are languages that are commonly spoken across New Hampshire, whether it's in immigrant or other new American communities.
Overall, Casey, how is absentee voting going?
It's going pretty, you know, at a pretty robust pace. As of earlier this week, the state has already surpassed the number of absentee ballots that that were cast in total in the 2016 election, or actually that was as of last week. So as of this week, October 20th is the latest data that we have. There have been 136,000 absentee ballots returned and about 200,000 absentee ballots requested. So that number could be even higher. And one of the things that I was looking at was I've kind of run the numbers up against like the 2016 turnout overall. So that would be in-person and absentee ballots, just to get a sense of how the pace is stacking up so far. And of course, you know, the absentee ballots that have come in still have to be reviewed. They still have to be counted. It's possible that, you know, some could be screened and, you know, may not end up being in the final count. But as a percent of 2016 turnout, about 18% of there have been, you know, the equivalent of 18% of the votes cast in 2016 have already been cast this year with several weeks left to go.
And what about mailing your ballots? Does the state, is it the position of the state that as of today, voters likely still have enough time if they put their absentee ballot in the mail today, it will arrive before close of business on Election Day?
So the state does not have a firm mailing deadline. What they do have is a recommendation. And what they recommend is that voters send their ballots 2 weeks ahead of an election. So that actually would have been earlier this week. And what's important to emphasize is that's not to say that if you mail it today, it won't arrive. We don't know that. And it's obviously dependent on a lot of factors. The other alternative, though, for people, if you do want to cast an absentee ballot, is to drop it off at your city or town hall, either during normal business hours, if you coordinate with your local clerk's office or double check, the hours that they will have staffed for people to receive your absentee ballots. And there's also actually a number of communities that are doing additional kind of absentee balloting events on the weekends, or, you know, just providing other opportunities to make sure that people have a safe and secure way to return their ballot if, you know, they don't want to do it in the mail.
Casey, are you hoping to hear from listeners on any particular kind of voting issue? And if so, what is that issue?
I think we're just looking to hear from people about what their absentee balloting experience has been like, and also hear from them about what kind of questions they have about voting or what the voting experience will be like in general this year. We would welcome questions, observations. If people have concerns, we certainly would like to hear those as well. And also if people have, you know, kind of success stories, we want to hear about people's experiences from a variety of perspectives. And if people want to get in touch, we would encourage them to email us at elections, that's elections plural, at nhpr.org.
Elections at nhpr.org. That's great. Thank you very much, Casey. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Peter.
NHPR's Casey McDermott has been covering voting for NHPR. She's going to be on this program again in a week or so to answer more of your questions. And of course, get in touch at elections at nhpr.org if you have a pressing question. And you can also check out NHPR's voting guide at nhpr.org if you've got questions. Just go to our website and you'll be able to find the voting guide. Let's turn now to NHPR's Sarah Gibson. She's been covering education and the challenges teachers, students, and parents are facing during this pandemic. Sarah Gibson, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Peter.
So, Sarah, we've been watching the state's COVID-19 cases going up this fall in multiple counties. How have schools been affected?
Well, you know, as we heard earlier on in the program, transmission level is substantial in three counties, so Rockingham, Merrimack, and Hillsborough. And in those places, you know, we have seen positive cases cause schools to go remote, at least for a time. And, you know, schools are certainly keeping an eye on levels of test positivity rates, hospitalization rates, as well as transmission in order to decide whether or not they should go remote or hybrid for a longer period of time to account for growing transmission levels in their communities.
And has a surge led schools to changing their approaches when it comes to remote learning or hybrid learning?
In some cases, yes. So Manchester paused their hybrid model for their high school because the risk level they deemed as moderate. They have a whole metric that you can actually look at online that they developed with their public health partners. And they basically say, you know, they're looking at a couple different things in the city, including you know, there being a substantial rate of transmission of COVID-19 right now. So they paused moving from remote to hybrid for the high schoolers. Nashua is still largely remote, though it's considering some hybrid for younger students later on this semester. You know, Concord has said that they will go remote if they have substantial rates of transmission in Merrimack County, and we do right now. However, the it seems like that's in large part because of a couple outbreaks at long-term care facilities. So Concord isn't yet going remote. They're looking at, outside of those long-term care facilities, what transmission rate is looking like, and also at that positivity rate that David Brooks was talking about earlier in the program, basically whether or not, the percentage of people who are testing positive is above 5%. And right now it's not, it's between 1% and 2%. So that is some relief to school leaders as they think about whether or not to shift to remote or hybrid learning.
And what does contact tracing look like in the schools? Is there a uniform picture you can paint about how schools across the state are doing it, or does it vary by community?
It really varies by community. So the official procedure is that when a school learns of a positive case, say a parent calls them or a staff member calls them and says, look, I just tested positive, they contact DHHS. And the idea is that DHHS then spearheads the contact tracing, although a school nurse or a COVID liaison at the district may begin the contact tracing process because they might, say, have the seating assignments for that student who just tested positive and be able to say within 10 minutes, oh yeah, we need to call these three families because there was likely close contact. So in general, DHHS is supposed to be overseeing this contact tracing, but we did report last week, and I continue to hear of some instances in the minority, but some instances in which schools really have to spearhead the contact tracing because they're not hearing back from DHHS fast enough. This might be because they learn of a positive case before DHHS even has that test result, or they hear about it on Friday afternoon or over the course of the weekend. Superintendents have to make a really quick decision about whether or not to close a school building. They make that decision sometimes in a matter of hours, and contact tracing is taking a long time. That's in part because it seems like the contact tracers, have a lot on their plate, but also because, it does seem like contact tracing is just getting more complicated. There are more contacts per case, we heard from DHHS in the last couple of weeks. Essentially because, people are out and about more, or they're maybe on a sports team, or they're hanging out with friends after school. So each positive case is more complicated. DHHS has said we have enough contact tracers. We're on top of this. But I do hear from some school officials that the contact tracing often, falls partially on them because DHHS has a lot more contact tracing to do across the state right now.
And what about the regular flu season? Is the seasonal flu causing kids to have to stay home from school?
I haven't heard. There are concerns about that. I haven't heard that there is substantial student absenteeism because of flu. Just as a reminder to listeners, there are really strict guidelines that schools have put in place where if you have unexplained sniffles or if you have a sore throat, pretty basic symptoms that could be a cold or could be flu, you have to stay home. And so it turns out that in a lot of schools, actually teachers are trying to be extra cautious and are staying home when they have any potential flu symptoms or COVID symptoms or cold symptoms. That's leading to a pretty tense situation with substitute teachers, actually. So I've heard in a number of schools, several staff will have to stay home because they have some symptoms. And basically, there just aren't substitute teachers who want to come into a building and for not significant pay, cover a teacher's shift. So what some teachers are being asked to do is actually cover each other's shift. So instead of having a planning period, say, they're running down the hall to oversee, another classroom, which means potentially more exposure for them, but also just a pretty exhausting schedule. So I've heard from several schools that the issue of substitute teachers as flu season comes upon us and as there's just more cold and flu symptoms, that's going to be a major, major concern and might mean that schools go remote, even though their transmission level is technically pretty low.
And how are schools preparing for the holiday season and the possibility that, in a month, a lot of people will travel for Thanksgiving and they may encounter COVID and there may be some transmission between communities, not just within a community. How are schools preparing for that?
Yeah, I would say it's one of the most stressful questions that are school leaders are dealing with, because a lot of people want to see parents and family. And, particularly as the transmission rates within New England increase, some people are saying, you know, why is it that my neighbor can go to Boston and not have to self-quarantine after Thanksgiving, but I can't go, I can't go to the Southeast, or I can't, visit family in upstate New York. And so there's been a lot of queries to districts. Look, do I have to follow the state's travel guidance? Which, as a reminder, it means if you go outside of New England and you come back, you got to self-quarantine. And that could mean a lot of people are home for a number of weeks after Thanksgiving. State health officials have said that teachers might be able to be considered as essential workers, and essential workers don't necessarily have to follow that strict travel guidance. Health officials have also said they are looking at this travel guidance in New Hampshire and considering updating it. But for now, districts have to develop their policies about whether or not, if you leave New England, particularly on public transportation, you have to self-quarantine upon return. And this request of districts to make a clear policy, it makes sense in the context of New Hampshire's kind of local control model, in which school boards and local school districts really do have a fair amount of autonomy. The problem with making this ask of districts is that not everyone's going to be happy with what a district decides, right? So there's going to be a lot of pushback from teachers as well as families with a district decision. And I've heard from school leaders an anxiety that as they make more hard and fast rules about travel and self-quarantine, there's going to be so much dismay and frustration within their community that it'll continue kind of eroding the school community relationship that is already pretty tense right now because of frustrations about pandemic education. So I'll certainly be looking for updated guidance from DHHS about this travel, but it's, I would say, one of the major concerns that district leaders have shared with state officials as we're looking to Thanksgiving as well as Christmas.
NHPR education reporter Sarah Gibson, thank you very much for speaking with me.
You're welcome.
And I'm sorry we didn't get a chance to talk about Sarah's story about how schools are keeping their music programs going, but you can find that at our website, nhpr.org, as well as all of NHPR's education reporting during the pandemic. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. And after a quick break, we're going down ballot, and we're talking about the county commissioner's role in New Hampshire's civic life. If you've got questions about it, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR, or shoot us an email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. County Commissioner. It's not an office most Granite Staters think about much, but voters will decide who their county commissioners will be this fall. As part of our series, Down Ballot, we're going to take a moment today to understand the role county commissioners play in our civil society. Paul G. Bergeron is Hillsborough County Commissioner District 2, which covers Hudson, Litchfield, Nashua, and Pelham. He is not running for re-election, but he is here with us this morning to help explain what the county commissioner does. Paul, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
So tell us about the job of county commissioner. What does the county commissioner do?
Well, every county, there's 10 counties in Hillsborough County, and every county operates just a little bit differently. But in Hillsborough County, we're responsible for, under our umbrella, is the Hillsborough County Nursing Home in Goffstown. So when you were talking earlier about nursing home care, that's primarily what we do. It's a 300-bed nursing home in Goffstown, New Hampshire. We're also under our umbrella is the Department of Corrections. As some know, the Valley Street Jail in Manchester, where all county people are held pending trial and some post-trial. Also under us is the Sheriff's Department, the Registry of Deeds, and the County Attorney's Office. In addition to that, we do provide financial assistance to a number of other organizations in New Hampshire. To name just a few would be the UNH Cooperative Extension, which we provide significant funding to, the Meals on Wheels program in Hillsborough County, and waypoints. So there's a lot that we're doing, and probably people are involved with county government. They just don't realize it on their day-to-day business.
And how many county commissioners are there per county?
There are three county commissioners. So we represent the entire Hillsborough County, which is from Pelham over to New Ipswich and up to Manchester, and then all the way up to Windsor in Hillsborough, New Hampshire, where people think my office is, but that's actually a town. Our offices are in Goffstown. Commissioner Tony Pappas represents District 1, which is Manchester, Bedford, and New Boston. I represent, as you said, Nashua, Hudson, Litchfield, and Pelham. And then Commissioner Bob Rowe from Amherst represents all the towns. So we have the two major cities in the state, Manchester and Nashua, and then obviously all the towns. So it's a pretty diverse sector that we cover in people as well.
And is this a very partisan position, Paul?
It absolutely is not. I have truly served, loved serving with Commissioner Rowe and Commissioner Pappas. And our county administrator is Chad Monier, and our legal counsel is Carolyn Kirby. And again, we're responsible primarily for the people and the residents under our care, which is close to 300 people when we're at capacity at our nursing home, most of whom are Medicare and Medicaid patients, although we do have some private pay, and then people that are being held at the Department of Corrections in Manchester. So we, you know, primarily are just looking to do the right thing most of the time. And it's just been, honestly, for me, a tremendous experience and opportunity.
And it is the role of county commissioner, the position, often a launching pad for different offices throughout the state?
Well, it depends on how you look at it. Some people say that it's been generally, in many instances, people who have been state representatives in folks that had served in the state house that ended up going to county government. Some of the things that people don't know when they're state representatives that they are automatically part of the Hillsborough County delegation, where they actually vote on each individual county's budget. But there are Representative Chris Pappas actually was a county treasurer in Hillsborough County, so I guess it could be.
Okay. Well, Paul G. Bergeron is Hillsborough County Commissioner, District 2, which covers Hudson, Litchfield, Nashua, and Pelham. Thank you very much for joining us for Down Ballot today. We appreciate your insights.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
And before we move on to an excerpt of our gubernatorial debate from earlier this week, just want to clarify one thing that was said on the air about ballots and mailing in your absentee ballot. We said that the state didn't have a hard deadline for mailing back your absentee ballot, as in when you need to drop it in your mailbox, but it does need to arrive by Election Day. So we just want to clarify that your ballot does need to arrive by 5 p.m. on Election Day by mail or in person. Again, if you have questions about how to vote in this year's election, you can check out NHPR's voter guide at nhpr.org, or you can also send a note to elections@nhpr.org, the email address elections@nhpr.org. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and Governor Chris Sununu and his Democratic challenger, State Senator Dan Feltes, met in a live debate earlier this week on NHPR. The two clashed over mental health policy, criminal justice, and taxes. Here, NHPR's Josh Rogers presses the candidates on the state's response to the coronavirus pandemic.
Governor, the latest COVID-19 case numbers have shown a spike. Cases are double what they were 2 weeks ago. Hospitalizations, while still low, are rising. I know you and your team say higher numbers are mostly tied to more testing, but throughout this pandemic, you've emphasized the need to let circumstances dictate if the state should, as you put it, flex in or flex out restrictions. Yeah. Should we be tightening up now? If so, how? And if not, what would be the benchmarks?
Well, cases are going up. Yeah, it's a great point. Cases are going up. It's something we've been talking about since May, knowing that in the fall, as schools open, as universities open, as we all kind of come indoors, cases are going to rise. They're rising much more drastically in other parts of the country, but we shouldn't think that that can't happen here. And unfortunately, as governor, my job is to plan for the worst and hope for the best. And so we've been able to put all of these new measures in place, whether it's our great job of getting PPE or testing better than almost any state in the country. As you noted, we used to do 500 tests a day. Now we do 10,000. And our percent positivity rate is still at about 1%. That's good. The number of individuals in hospitals is, I think today, of 16 or 17. It used to be well over 100. So we have a lot of capacity in the healthcare system to make sure it doesn't get overrun. And we've opened up, whether it's schools or restaurants or retail, in a very surgical and strategic way. So if we have to flex, like we did with hockey this week, very, very tough decision to make, but we can be very strategic about how we flex things as we go forward. But we're going to use the data and Dr. Chan and the team at Department of Public Health to inform us.
You do mention hockey rinks, Governor, and we've had clusters and feared community spread out of restaurants. You know, case numbers out of schools, infections as a percentage of population are quite small, but some districts have closed temporarily, decisions that they're making on their own. You know, given the clusters we've had from indoor restaurant dining and some church gatherings, things that you shut down earlier this year, should you consider limits in those segments of our society again?
Not at this time. I mean, it's something we're going to keep looking. We look at the data, not day by day, like hour by hour, actually, as it comes in. So that's probably not something we're looking to do now. We always have other cards to play. But luckily, when we see a cluster or a spike, we work with the restaurant, we work with the organization, and usually can get folks on a better path. And the results show. We have still some of the lowest numbers in the country, one of the strongest economies in the country. But it's because Dr. Chan, the Department of Public Health, and myself, we're very specific about how we go about it. But we always have another card to play.
One more follow-up to you, Governor. Something that's become more apparent as we get deeper into the pandemic is the disproportionate economic effect COVID-19 has had on women, higher rates of unemployment, higher rate of wage loss, and, you know, the real possibility that some of the lost jobs may not return. What policy should the state adopt to ensure that economic losses borne by women don't become permanent? 30 seconds.
Are you asking specifically to women?
Yes.
So, you know, we set up, there's a couple issues when you talk about women or minorities, when you talk about the disparity in just healthcare or the disparity in the workplace. We're ranked as one of the best states in the country. We used to be number 30. I think we're now number 5 in terms of equity pay, for example. They have that Gini coefficient, which looks at equity pay with men and women, and across the board, we're one of the best in the country with what we call our middle class pay, lowest poverty rate in the country, some of the highest wages. So I don't think it's about going after one specific area. It's about making sure the jobs are there. You have the management experience to open the economy back up, and we've been very successful so far.
Thanks, Governor. You, Senator Feltes, if you were governor right now, what would you do now given the case numbers we're seeing on the coronavirus front?
We got to listen to the medical experts. That's something that Donald Trump and Kristen Noem don't do on masks, for example, a common sense public mask requirement to make sure that we take care of our people. Those are what the medical experts have recommended. Actually do a school reopening plan, not punt it down to the local level like Trump and Sununu did. And it's not enough just to criticize Trump and Sununu for not doing anything on school reopening, no public health standards. We put forward our own plan, Live Free and Learn Safe, informed by medical experts, informed by including the former commissioner of HHS, Ned Helms. So we got to look out for our people on the ground. We also got to look out for our healthcare system and make sure that we protect and strengthen Obamacare. And Chris Sununu, just like Donald Trump, supports the repeal of Obamacare. And Chris Sununu, just like Donald Trump, has rolled back and restricted access to safe, legal abortion. And you know what? You're going to hear a lot today of, you know, Donald Trump gives himself an A+, Chris Sununu gives himself a gold standard. But to move forward, we got to protect and strengthen our health care system.
Senator, polling indicates most Granite Staters approve of Governor Sununu's performance managing the pandemic. A UNH poll last week put the numbers at, I think, 83%, including 70% of Democrats. So why are the people who think the governor's done a good job on this front wrong?
The people I talk to, they need help. They're struggling. Working families are struggling. They don't know what the next week will bring, let alone the next day. And health insurance and our health care is critical in the midst of a pandemic. As a legal aid lawyer, I fought the health insurance companies for about 10 years, getting access to health care, including during the last economic crisis, the Great Recession, battling Wall Street banks who were foreclosing on folks all across New Hampshire. As a state senator, battled the health insurance industry to get prescription drug relief, Medicaid expansion, protect pre-existing conditions. While I was taking on the health insurance companies, Chris Sununu literally took over $100,000 in campaign contributions from the health insurance industry, supports the repeal of Obamacare. If we're going to move forward together, we got to protect and strengthen Obamacare. It has a Supreme Court argument on November 10th. Judge Barrett being put forth by President Trump. Chris Sununu supports that process going forward. And look, we got to move forward together, lift each other up. The stories of working families and healthcare stability is critical to moving forward in this pandemic.
Governor, we're going to let you get a chance to discuss this on a healthcare segment a bit later in the show. But one more for you, Senator Feltes. You know, many businesses that would have been devastated this spring when unemployment was really at its height were kept afloat by federal aid. You know, more of that could be coming to New Hampshire. But if more restrictions, economic restrictions, end up being needed later this fall and this winter, and more money doesn't come from Washington, what would you do to support businesses that might otherwise be ravaged by the economic impacts of the pandemic?
Well, we needed to support businesses and small businesses in particular with the COVID CARES Act relief funds. Look, there's $1.25 billion that was taken control of by Chris Sununu, unilateral control. And you know what? I'd ask people listening and watching at home, how much of Chris Sununu's $1.25 billion did you get? How much did your family get? I bet you didn't get much. You know who got a lot? Corporate campaign donors of Chris Sununu's campaign. And that's a God's honest truth. So we got to look out for small businesses on Main Street, working people and working families, and strengthen and bolster our healthcare system.
That's State Senator and Democratic gubernatorial candidate Dan Feltes and Republican Governor Chris Sununu debating on NHPR this week. You can listen to the full debate anytime at nhpr.org. And that's it for today. You can find all the links to the stories that we discussed today at nhpr.org. And just a reminder, since voting is top of mind for so many people, please remember we do have that comprehensive voting guide for you to check out at nhpr.org. Ellen Grimm produced the show today. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our regular theme music was composed by Bob Lord. And I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Stitcher for NHPR Exchange.